In recent years, it seems like the word apocalypse has often been preceded by the modifier zombie. Our popular culture creates a lot of stories about what the future might be like, and a lot of it is not very pleasant, often featuring a blasted landscape filled with renegades and survivalists and zombies and other colorful and scary figures. Your actual apocalypse may vary, if you even get one. Our guest this hour studies past societies and has great knowledge of what proved to be their undoing. He casts his gaze at the present world as well and forward in a new book. Chris Begley is the author of The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. Chris Begley is an anthropology professor, an underwater archaeologist, and a wilderness survival instructor. Chris has worked in all the Americas and around the Mediterranean, is a National Geographic explorer, and hosts a public radio show on the post-pandemic future. Chris Begley, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
I would have guessed from your work you've probably seen plenty of places visited by apocalypse, or at least by some sort of societal collapse.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, almost everything we look at as archaeologists has, it's gone, you know. And so there's been some sort of calamity on some scale that has befallen all of these areas. And in some cases where I've worked most extensively in Central America, there are, you know, areas that really underwent some significant changes.
Well, so granted, things have happened to people in the past. Does that make it natural or a little weird that we think so much about future apocalypses and make movies about them and all that sort of thing?
Well, I don't know. I think that there's certainly something revealing about it, whether it's natural or weird or not, I don't know. But one of the things that we see if we look back over time, not only in our sort of popular narratives about how these calamities might come to pass, but also when we look at how archaeologists explained what happened in the past, we see these concerns with current events show up in those interpretations or in those representations.
Are you concerned about current events in our time, you mean?
Yeah, for instance, during the Vietnam War, for instance, warfare as a theme of the cause of societal collapse was sort of arose and was very common. More recently, we look at climate-related things, and obviously, these reflect the types of things we're thinking about.
Oh, interesting. So we're coming from a place of look, it happened to them.
Yes.
Uh-huh. There is a certain, when we look about the when we consider the future, though, in our popular culture stuff, the, you know, zombie apocalypse movies and all that, there's a bit of finality to our imaginings. But is it always quite as final when you look at the records of past civilizations? Do the societies ever collapse a little?
Yeah. In fact, when we look at what has actually happened, through the lens of archaeology, but also through the lens of history and even lived experience, we see that these things are rarely as sudden and final and dramatic even as what we see in these narratives. What we do see when we look at things like the decline of the classic Maya in Mexico and Central America, or of the Western Roman Empire, is something that took decades, even centuries, to come to fruition. And at the end, you may have something that, you know, seems very dramatic when it all sort of comes to a head, but it's been building for a long time. And if we're going to look at these causes, you know, it's not like, the zombie apocalypse or the even the other sort of outbreak narratives where something starts and then very quickly things fall apart. Usually we see that these things have taken a long time to happen.
Does your teaching of wilderness survival courses, Chris, have a connection to your anthropology and archaeology work?
Yeah, well, certainly it does in the sense that one of the areas in which I worked for a long time was Central America. In particular, I worked in eastern Honduras in a place called the Mosquito Coast, or the Mosquitia, and it's a rainforest, and it's very sparsely populated. And so I would live in either communities which had very little in the way of infrastructure, no electricity, no water. And often we would take extended trips through the rainforest documenting archaeological sites. And these may last 2 or 3 weeks, and we may do one after another. So one of the things that happened is that I realized at a certain point that the kinds of things I was learning from the folks I was with were the sorts of things we talk about as survival skills. So in that way, there's certainly a connection.
So things like how to shelter yourself and how to feed yourself and get water when you're trapped out in a place you didn't expect to be trapped.
Exactly. How to make fire in the rain. And many of these things, you know, of course, when I was living in these communities, it was not a survival situation. I mean, there were wonderful places for me, typically, and I enjoyed it. But you did have to make fire. You did have to purify water. And certainly when we're out traveling through the rainforest, also not a survival situation per se, but one in which you use these same kinds of skills.
You started the Next Apocalypse, the book, before the COVID pandemic. I mean, how much of actual events that have unfolded support or change your views about societal collapse?
Well, it certainly, in some ways it provided a lot of material. In other ways, there were so many things happening that it was hard to sort of keep up. You think you're writing a book about sort of historical things and these current narratives, and what you find out is that you have to keep up with current events. But there were definitely some things that were very different than I expected.
All right, we'll continue in a conversation with Chris Begley about the kinds of ways in which societal declines happen and whether or not they can, in fact, be termed collapses. There's some debate about that, as we'll discuss in the next segment. Chris's book is The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. We'll come back to the conversation on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join in by phone and email when we come back in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of JPR, Chris Begley is our guest, an underwater archaeologist, wilderness survival instructor, and anthropology professor. He has studied many past civilizations and includes in his latest book some details of what happened to the Maya civilization, the Western Roman Empire, and the Native Americans of the Eastern Woodlands. He himself is from Kentucky and lives there now. You can join the conversation as we talk about his book, The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. Join us on the Exchange by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. You make it pretty clear, Chris, you're not trying to scare people with this book, but you do say that we are preparing for the wrong disaster. In what sense?
Well, one of the things that I've seen as somebody that does teach wilderness skills is, I come in contact with sort of the world of preppers, and I come in contact with a lot of people that are interested in preparing. And one of the things that I noticed was that there tends to be this real focus on the individual or familial or small group preparation. And there seems to be this idea that we're going to weather this thing with a small group of folks, you know, up in the hills using our survival skills. And that's just not what we've ever seen. What we have always seen, even in situations where there was extreme disruption, like in the eastern United States with the arrival of Europeans and the advent of diseases there, even in those cases, people maintain or reform communities, and that's how you get through it.
All right, so a greater sense of community than not just going about this individually.
Well, and that implies a whole other set of things that we might need to do. In some ways, for many of us, it would be much easier if you could just be with a small group of people that you select and be out in the woods using your wilderness skills to survive. That would, it might be hard to do, but it's very simple. You're focused, etc. Living in a community, especially a community with lots of needs, going through lots of changes, is really hard. You have, a disparate population, a diverse population, different ideas about everything, different ways of going about things. And you have to do that. And you can't worry about finding food for five people. You have to worry about it for 5,000 or 50,000.
So let's look backward again, because the assumptions that people make now about so-called collapses in the past, as you point out in the book, there's even some debate about the use of that term collapse.
Yeah. A lot of archaeologists would hesitate to use that term, especially in some cases that we have. In other cases, it might be a good term for the kind of relatively quick and dramatic changes you have, but one of the things that it implies sort of necessarily is sort of this finality, and also really this failure. If something has collapsed, somehow it's failed. And we just see that it's much more complex than that. In many cases, things change, but they don't disappear. One example of that would be when people ask why the Maya disappeared. And of course, that is an insulting question to the 7 or 8 million Maya that live in exactly the same part of the world that they lived in 1,200 years ago when they were undergoing these changes. But things change, and part of why we see this finality is that we might latch on to certain things that change, the way they construct buildings or make monuments or how they spread across the landscape. When in reality, those things have changed and the people persevere in other forms.
Well, there's a certain level of denigration in there, too, as you point out. I mean, compare, for example, the perceived collapse, quote unquote, of Maya civilization with, for example, the abandonment of Stonehenge in England.
Yeah, I think that's a very good example. Nobody asks... what happened to your ancestors? Were they unable to make it and they abandoned this stuff? And now they're reduced to this other sort of existence. But that's exactly the way we talk about these things in other contexts. And so in all of these discussions, we see reflected many of the types of things we think, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Chris Begley is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. Well, let's go with that thread then, because it's not just about misunderstanding the way people lived in the past. It's also about misunderstanding the way people live in the present, as you point out. I mean, the idea of living in the rainforest, oh no, that thick jungle. I mean, and the fact is that people thrive in that environment because they know it.
Yeah. One thing, I really can't count the number of articles about either my work in the rainforest or other folks' work in the rainforest that use phrases like the impenetrable jungle. It's not. In fact, if I were to pick a place to have to survive, it would be the rainforest. Now, partly that's because I'm familiar with it, but partly because of all the resources there. At any moment, there are literally tens of thousands or more, perhaps, tens of thousands of children playing in the rainforest. You know, it is not this adventurous landscape that we like to make it out to be. But of course, you know, that allows us to present ourselves as heroic, right, for somehow surviving that hostile landscape.
Well, it is, again, a sort of a looking down upon other societies, and not just on other shores, because there's some stories that are told of the pre-European people in what is now Kentucky, where you live.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the ideas that we often have, the erroneous ideas, is that, you know, these folks were sort of passive recipients of this disaster that happened. Now, it is true that disease came for which people had not developed any kind of immunity and all of that, but it's not true that communities were not taking steps to mitigate the disaster, to preserve themselves and their way of life. And they made, you know, real differences, even if it was ultimately tragic. You know, one of the things we often do is remove the agency or the ability to act from people that that we have marginalized.
So basically those poor guys, they were caught unprepared when in fact they took efforts like any society would to try to hold off the disaster.
Yeah, and some would be understandable to us, cleanliness and isolation and avoidance, and others are part of a religious tradition or a cosmovision that we don't share and would be hard maybe to understand those of us not part of that group. But in any case, in all of these different ways, there was, you know, they were not passive recipients of this disaster.
Well, and then we can take this to our own time and consider our own responses to our own ongoing two-year crisis now. I mean, you talk about the early days of the pandemic, you thinking it'll blow over fairly soon. What do you think now about the responses we had early in the pandemic and what those might illustrate about ways in which societies have faced similar issues in the past?
Yeah, well, you know, there were a few things that were unexpected. Maybe not to everybody that thinks about this, but to me, one was the politicization of the entire thing. You know, the anti-mask, the anti-vaccine movements that go beyond sort of the anti-vaxxers that existed before. It's clearly a political thing, and that was not an area where I thought there would be disagreement, you know. And now, you know, we joke about a zombie movie where there's a big chunk of the population that, you know, refuses to believe they're zombies or that this is effective against zombies. And so this was not sort of in those tropes that we see in those movies, and that was unexpected. Some things were expected, and they really played out in kind of dramatic and obvious fashion, like the variable impact of the pandemic on different groups based on your socioeconomic level or nationality or race or relationship with the power structures that exist.
Indeed, and it fell hardest on people of a lower socioeconomic status, basically in browner skin, too, it seems like.
That's right. And of course, you know, there a history of understanding that a level of distrust is warranted creates a distinct response. And so, yeah.
We were talking about societal responses to disasters with Chris Begley, who is an underwater archaeologist and anthropology professor and a wilderness survival instructor living in Kentucky, and he's talking to us from there. His book is called The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. You're more than welcome to get into the conversation, talk about your thoughts about societies that have had declines in the past and the causes thereof and how we might avoid their fate. 800-838-3760 is our phone number, 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So again, the civilizations that you spend some time looking at here, primarily in the book, with some other thrown in there with it, Maya civilization, the Western Roman Empire, Native Americans of the Eastern Woodlands in what's now the United States. As you look at them, I mean, were these as you, well, you've already pointed out with the Maya, they're still there. They still live there, but the old structures of society, for example, have been left behind. Do we know what drove those, and were there multiple causes?
Yeah, that's, you know, one of the things I wanted to look at was, how do we understand these past collapses? How do we even talk about what happened? And how can that let us think about what's going to happen in the future? When we look at the causes, one of the things is that there might be what we often call a proximate cause, or sort of the original thing that happens that sets off this chain of events. And it may or may not be significant in and of itself. I mean, one, we can look at that in a modern setting. If we look at our supply chain problems, they're clearly related to COVID. I mean, they're related to some other things as well, of course, but it's not that the disease has, you know, sort of wiped out the people that are involved in this. It's that because of shutdowns and a whole other a set of circumstances, different behavior in consumers, or our reliance on certain types of shipping, these big ships that can only dock at certain ports, for instance, we have these issues. And so when we look at why it is that we're seeing empty shelves in the grocery store, it's not just the virus. It's a whole set of things that this set in motion. So we see that archaeologically as well, where you have a variety of things that happen after some initial thing. But often it's hard to identify even what these causes were. In the case of the Maya, for instance, in the past we've posited drought. And we see that in some places there was severe drought. In other places we don't really have evidence for it. So it's not consistent across the area. We talk about warfare, but we don't really even have a baseline for what warfare looked like prior to this, to the last bit of the classic Maya civilization. So we don't know the degree to which it caused things. So looking for causes is very tricky.
And how, I mean, these are some fairly long declines, aren't they? Particularly in the case, for example, of the Western Roman Empire. This is not something that happened with a cataclysm or anything like that.
No, and in fact, very few people would talk about what happened there as a collapse. You know, it was this long, slow decline. And in fact, there's terms that people use that capture just how long and slow this decline was. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence that, especially when you get to the outskirts of the empire, that the impact or the realization that these kinds of changes had happened might be limited. In other words, you know, it may not have impacted people in the same way. So, yeah, we see these long processes happening, and that partly creates the difficulty in looking for a cause, because are we looking at something that was precipitated by something already happening, or is this the thing that set it off?
And it's interesting too to look at those three examples again. So in terms of speed or not, Western Roman Empire, then I'd say the Maya civilization, but the Native Americans, obviously the Native American societies might be considered closest to complete collapse or speedy collapse. And yet, as you point out, people and culture survive.
Yeah, yeah. We've sort of tried to have it both ways. By we, I mean immigrants to the Americas, non-Native Americans. For a long time, we underestimated the number of people that had died in with the arrival of Europeans to the Americas. And, you know, recently our estimates of something like 90 to 95% of the population dying within a century of the arrival of Europeans is broadly accepted. So in some ways we minimize the disaster, but then on the other hand, we would tend to talk about it as if it just wiped out Native Americans and we can proceed without considering them, you know, which is, of course, a very convenient truth if you're dealing with things like occupation of land and that sort of thing. In Kentucky, we have a legend, a myth, and it's wrong, that Kentucky was a hunting ground and that Native Americans didn't live here. They just came here to hunt. That's demonstrably not true, but it persists for many reasons. And I suspect one reason is because it makes the story of people like me, European, of European descent, more palatable to ourselves.
Which gets to the whole issue of, for example, the discussion of parts of the American West as being this vast wilderness that it was just waiting for us to occupy, and in fact it was well occupied with people who had lived here for thousands and thousands of years. So there's a trend here for lack of a better term, the winners write the history books is essentially the trend we're talking about here, isn't it? That the people who are around to write history books are the ones who get to say what the story was.
That's right. And that's, you know, as an archaeologist, one of the things that many of us see as part of our role in creating a story of the past is to look at things in a different light, to look at a different set of information, to look at things that have not been written by the winners. Now, of course, we still suffer from that same phenomena. You look at the demographic makeup of archaeologists, and you're still seeing that we have a lot of work to do to get the variety of stories out that need to be out there.
I mean, the demographic variety within archaeology itself, you're saying? People in the
field?
Yeah.
The diversity of the field.
All right. Some place to work on then as well. We'll come back to talk more with Chris Begley, who is himself an archaeologist and an anthropology professor and a wilderness survival instructor. His book is The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. We'll talk about societies and their demises or not, and how we can think about this in terms of what's coming down the road for humans in our time. Join us on The Exchange when we return in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Chris Begley, anthropology professor, underwater archaeologist, wilderness survival instructor based in Kentucky, a longtime resident of Kentucky, is our guest on The Exchange. He uses three major society collapses, if you want to call them that, in the past, to talk about the general trend of what happens to civilizations over time. He looks at the Maya civilization, the Western Roman Empire, and Native Americans of the Eastern Woodlands in what is now the United States, and then casts ahead to other societies or casts back to other societies and ahead to us and what could happen to us and how we prepare for the future in his book, The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. You're welcome to join this conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we've already perused briefly some of the literature and popular culture, movies mostly about post-apocalyptic worlds. Is there any that stay with you more than others, Chris, as you examine the field?
Yeah, there's certainly many that are notable for many reasons, even if they embody these things that I think are erroneous. One of the best examples of that would be Cormac McCarthy's The Road. A fantastic book. I really like the movie as well. And none of that looks like a probable scenario. But that, is of course not what it's about. There is also a sort of a set of literature that is written by folks that are coming at it from different perspectives. And I think one example that I would use would be N.K. Jemisin's work, where that an African-American writer who writes in a way that looks differently at this future. Now, that's sort of a fantastic and not a very realistic future, but in the ways that certain things play out, it's very different. And then there's some others that I think came very close to getting it right. You know, one of those is a book called Lucifer's Hammer, which came out in the 70s and really focuses on groups of people in the aftermath of a disaster, a comet striking the Earth in that case.
Do you find much less writing about past disasters? I was curious about the part of your book where you point out there are a few novels about the so-called Spanish flu, for example.
Yeah. And, partly, one of the points that I make there is that in these narratives, and this may be understandable because they are narratives that are being sold as books and movies. In these narratives, you have heroic people doing heroic things on sort of an understandable time scale, something that fits in the novel, fits in the book. In reality, what we see, for instance, in this pandemic, is that what we needed to do is stay at home, not interact, put on a mask, get a vaccine. None of that is heroic in the sense that that you might see in a movie. Nobody, it's not Brad Pitt flying around to find the cure for the zombie plague in World War Z. It's something that's very domestic. And in the same way, what happened during the Spanish flu pandemic is not very cinematic. The way we got out of it is not going to make a good movie.
So it seems like what goes on in the good movies then, what does make a good movie, also potentially makes for some bad survival training, that we're trying to get to this point where we want to be heroic. Is that part of what fuels preppers, for example, in our time?
Well, I think so. I think there's a wide variety of people that you might put in that category. But I think partly the way that we think about these things, involves sort of this individual action at a moment of crisis that somehow mitigates the disaster or solves the problem, and I do this as much as anybody. When my kids were little, in my mind, there was a time when I got malaria and I was really sick with malaria. And in the midst of all the kinds of thoughts that came to me in those instances, was this idea that I wouldn't be able to physically carry my kids to safety in case of that something happened. Now, the chances of my ever having to do that are very minimal. But for whatever reason, that was the kind of thing I thought about. And so, yeah, we do think about these things, partly because that's a narrative that we hear. And that's how we imagine the response to a crisis would be.
So the heroic protecting my family aside, is there some other appeal to life after what we have now? If society collapses, for example, as you point out in the book, there are people who say, I won't have to pay my student loans.
Yeah. I think a lot. I think part of what the vast number of these apocalyptic narratives suggest is that maybe it reflects some fears or concerns that we have, but it also reflects these desires. And I think one of the great desires there is this sort of getting back to some mythical past. I mean, we hear this all the time, everything from, you know, make America great again stuff to just lamenting the good old days, right? We have this idea that if things could just be simplified, if I could just declutter my world and get down to the basics, I would be happy. We would be happy. Things would be sort of restored to some sort of natural or correct order. And of course, you know, it's never been that way. When we look at, you know, anybody that comes from a small town and has moved to a city will tell you, negotiating the reality of a small town can be much more difficult than negotiating the life in a city with the potential anonymity, for instance. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have these ideas that it would solve some of our problems.
There's a real macho element to this, though, a real, you know, the back to the time when men were men sort of thing. I think in movies like The Silent Place, you can see a stronger feminist strain coming up here, but it doesn't seem like there's a very well-developed strain there yet.
Well, there's definitely sort of this, you know, getting back to traditional manly skills part of it, the lumberjack type thing. And, you know, one of the things I point out is having lived in places where people do these things all the time, first of all, it's everybody that does it. You know, if I want to point out who is it out collecting, cutting firewood, it's not the men any more than it is the women. In fact, it's much more likely to be women. All of these things that we have created this gendered idea of because of our particular history, you know, it's not the way it plays out elsewhere, but we have overlain on it, you know, obviously this these ideas about masculinity, and that has to do with who's talking about it and at what point in time they're talking about it.
One particular point I want to ask about, which is a notable uptick in gun sales during the pandemic in the United States. Does that appear to be some sort of thing along this strain of like, I need to protect my family, my stuff, et cetera?
Well, you have to imagine that is part of it. I think that another part is political, you know, the with the you know, polarization of the population, with the way that the right talks about the left, and you know, to some degree in reverse, or ideas about the possibility of some sort of civil war or insurrection. I think that all of these things have contributed to that, you know. And also, I think part of it is that is sort of a tangible thing you could do. Right, like a lot of the preparations, you can buy weapons or equipment or guns or or food, or add on to your property or whatever it is that you're doing to prepare. All of that makes us feel like we're not just sitting around and waiting.
All right, and I can see too how that would feel a lot more I don't know, manly or effective or something than buying an 18-pack of Charmin, for example.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, so let's spend the final 5 minutes we have talking about the direction that you would advise that we do look. First of all, but potential causes of apocalypse. I mean, are societies even necessarily sure one has begun?
Yeah. Well, I you know, I would say that many of us looking at things would see climate change as really the thing that's going to upset what we have going on now. And one of the points that I make, but many archaeologists have made as well, is that what ends up collapsing or what ends up falling apart are these complex systems. And we have to look at, how these things might fall apart and what might affect them. And I think climate change is going to be one. It's going to change food production. It's going to change the way people are spread across the landscape. It's going to change the viability of living in certain places. You're going to get people moving. You're going to get the climate migrants, which we already see, climate refugees. That's going to stir up political issues, as we've seen in many places of Europe, or even if we look here. I mean, part of the reasons people are coming from Central America, crossing our southern border, has to do with economics, but part of that has to do also with changing climate. So, if I'm looking at these things, I would say it has begun a long time ago, and we are just now starting to see undeniable visible effects. I mean, we had people writing about it in, 1912, but it's getting to the point where it's very hard to deny it. And the denials are couched in political positions.
We have talked often about climate change and the ways that people respond to it. And it seems like a constant issue is, I don't know what I should be doing. Is that the wrong question too? Is it more like a what we should be doing together?
Well, I think one of the things, is to understand that, like a lot of this stuff, we often get sold on these individual actions. You know, you should recycle. You should have a car that is more efficient. You should ride your bicycle. When we know that the great majority of the type of pollution that is causing climate change comes from industry. So, I mean, partly we need to understand what's actually happening and organize to make those things happen. And, if I was going to suggest the things that are that are critical for negotiating whatever is about to come would be the ability to think clearly and critically and make good, informed, rational decisions, to listen to people that know what they're talking about and know how to distinguish that, to know how and when to question these things and to make sure we have checks and balances on these people. And really, we often focus on being a leader. We need also to learn how to be a follower, how to be one of the crowd, how to be a member of a community, because ultimately that's what we are in far more instances than we are the leader of something.
So from what you're saying, then it sounds like, don't look at these as single threads. They all tend to be interrelated. And particularly when we get to things like the rise of authoritarianism in other parts of the world, and to some degree in the United States as well, this is because of fear of some catastrophe as well, it seems.
Yeah, there's, I think a lot of that, a lot of the behavior that we imagine will be judged harshly looking back in the future by historians, it is driven by some sort of fear that you're losing power, fear that things are changing in ways that you don't understand. And, information and education, I guess, are a big part of the solution.
They really are. Chris Begley, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, anthropology professor, underwater archaeologist, wilderness survival instructor from Kentucky, the author of the book, The Next Apocalypse, The Art and Science of Survival. Chris, thanks so much for sharing it with us on the Exchange.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey.